Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR all around the world from Beijing to Budapest. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we seem to have listeners in Budapest. We're also podcasting. You can find this program at santafe.radiocafe.org where you can listen any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Sally Denton. She is the author of the new book, Passion and Principle, John and Jesse Fremont, the couple whose power, politics, and love shaped 19th century America. Right now, I'd like to welcome Victor DeSouvreau. He's a poet, and he is Penny Whistle Press. He's with Penny Whistle Press. He has a new book called Moving On. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you here. Let's talk about the title of the book, Moving On.
So much of our civilization depends on an attempt to keep things as they are.
Certainly in Santa Fe.
Exactly. And it's always, all of the good things in life happen when you just get off your duff and start moving on. And it was time, with particularly in terms of the political as well as the social situations that exist, that this book had to come about, because people generally think of poetry as a static, singular expression that unfortunately in this country has become very private and self-reflective. My poetry is based on the poetry of connection, the kind of poetry that is known as poetry in South America and in Europe. But in America, poetry has become much too self-reflective, and the poet's attitude has not really gotten involved in the attitudes and the problems of the day. And consequently, I thought it would be a good idea to put a book out that would have a title that would deal with those specific aspects.
So do you think that poetry in Latin America, in other parts of the world, is really of a different nature than poetry here in the United States? It seems that we have such a huge diversity.
We do have a huge diversity, but the connection between spoken art and the public in the United States has really been taken over by rap, has been taken over by other means of communication rather than poetry itself. But poetry is timeless, and the poetry of Homer, the poetry of Dante, just as the poetry of Dylan Thomas and Robinson Jeffers, the poetry of Rudy Anaya, poetry that is written today, should all reflect the life of today, not only the personal life and the feelings that are involved in how one gets up in the morning or how the spring comes. And a poet, the idea of the poet relaxing in a field or in a closet is not my way of looking at poetry. Poetry is something that should be shared and should excite people. Garcia Lorca did it. And when I went down to Machu Picchu, having gone down to Peru a few years ago, I was confronted by one of the guards who was reading a book of poems in Quechua, and I said, "What language is that?" And he said, "Quechua." I said, "I didn't know they were writing poetry in Quechua. I thought it was a dead language." He said, "It's the spirit of our people. There are 5 million Quechua speakers." And
I think it's the most widely spoken indigenous language in the hemisphere.
Yes. And so he said, "Why do you ask?" Because looking at my clothes, he said, you're a North American, and there are no poets. I said, "How about Maya Angelou and Ginsberg?" And went on to list a couple of others of my friends, and his answer was very simple. They're too interested in themselves. They're not poets. But we are interested in it, and we have a few poets here who are also guards here. And he was very, very simple and kind. And he said, "Would you like to have breakfast?" So I went and I met five of them. And I didn't know what to say when I walked in, because I couldn't say I'm just a poet. I really am a poet. And So I started to give them a poem in Spanish that I knew, one of Garcia Lorca's, Verde que te quiero verde, verde sangre, verde luna. And that got nowhere because they were not really connected to a revolutionary gay poet who had been killed by Franco some 40 years before in Spain. So I quickly switched to some lines of Neruda, and all of a sudden, un cafecito, señor, and it was just absolutely wonderful. He said, you had poets, you had Whitman, you had Sandburg, you had Crane, but you now, you're only interested in writing the poetry for yourselves. And so I took that as a lesson also, because it underlines the fact that poetry is timeless, and this is why we still read Shakespeare, why we still read Homer, and the poetry has its own time and its own age. And one of the essential elements is that it's up to the poet to keep the language moving, and this is why Woody Guthrie has been wonderful, and Joan Baez does her number, and that's where the poetry has gone. But on the printed page, the poet has to be responsible, and responsible in communication, not in just playing with words and dealing with themselves.
We're talking with Victor DeSouvreau, and he is actually going to be launching this new book on Sunday, the 20th of May, from 4 to 7, right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company, and the public is invited. The book is called Moving On. Well, to illustrate what you're saying, why don't we hear a poem?
I'd love to. Well, this one, we were talking about time. It's time. Out of the quicksand, out of the swamp between the two rivers, out of the excuses for torture we intend when we invent words like rendition, out of the hypocrisy that tatters the work of all of us who have done what is fair in the past, granted the prior disasters, the decimation of the Pequods, the so-called witches burned at Salem, granted Kit Carson and all Indian killers, granted the lynchings in the South, the Maya, the Mafia Dons and the Malays, the riots in Watts, Emmett Till and all the others namelessly and legally killed in Attica before Abu Ghraib was invented, it's time to move forward. We are our own dividers, killing our own kind at Bull Run, Appomattox, and even in the hospitals in the Big Easy, while teaching the young ones we enlist to hang suspects by their wrists before killing them. It's time to turn again, for there is love to be had for all of us in comfort, without the snare of duplicity, without the betrayals, and to move forward into the new dawn that is lighting the fires of sustainability, of balance, of truth-telling. It's time to get out of the swamp. There are more of us in this world who are of the kind who would not want their own children to become the child killers of the future. Our liberty bell may be cracked a bit, but still rings its demand that we join with, not against, the others, and move forward into the light, the air that made this country refuge, beacon of hope and example of light once again in the world.
Victor DeSouvreau. It's interesting. I was listening to that and thinking it's a call to action. What are the actions that you think one people should do?
Each person with a conscience and with any kind of intelligence and with an ability to look into the world will find their own answers. And you don't always have to be serious. In order to balance the work, I'd like to read you a very short one because the personal has to also be involved. Pablo Neruda was a wonderful example of that. The name of this one is Are They the Same? In Spanish, I want you and I love you use the same words. Yo te quiero are the same words. In no other language that I know is it put so clearly. And are they really the same, or are they equivalent in other ways, wanting and loving? Are they the two sides of the coin, or is one a reflection of the other? Today and every day I wake, I ask myself to take another look to see whether they are the same in Spanish or in any other tongue.
Victor DeSouvreau, I was reading through some of your poems, and I was wondering, what is the difference? Some of them makes one wonder more than others, but between poetry and prose.
Prose has a responsibility of giving meaning in a declaratory, direct fashion. Poetry has a different responsibility. Poetry's responsibility is to evoke, is to make you think not only in a logical ABC way, but in order to give you a revelation, in order to make you think and feel in ways that are surprises.
How can you tell when it's working?
When people say yes, and it's always delightful when I do have a reading or hand a book of poems to a person who will read one, and they'll finish a poem and then they say yes. And it's that yes that I work for, to get people to really recognize that what I've given them in the writing is something that is important enough for them to say yes.
I was thinking about Neruda, because I was rereading his autobiography a while back, and Neruda and many Latin American poets really did change people's lives. It wasn't a solipsistic, looking in the mirror of 20 of your best friends read it kind of thing. It was a form of communication, and perhaps still is. I don't know really what's going on in terms of poetry in Latin America. But to what extent are you driven by the effect that it could or that you hope has on people versus the effect of simply crafting the poem?
I don't think the two are separate. I think they're both not only connected, but they're integral parts of each other. I think that a responsible poet has to learn his craft as well as his art. And Dylan Thomas said it, in terms of the art and craft being all one and the same. Because a poet who is only driven by personal inspiration and has no personal responsibility in terms of the world, plays with himself and has no responsibility. Go through history, Robinson Jeffers in California, Kenneth Rexroth, but you mentioned Neruda. Neruda was, he gave up the position that would have made him president instead of Allende to his friend Allende, who ended up being killed. But he was a social activist, and he was very much involved. And look at the Russian poets, Yevtushenko and all of the Mayakovsky, all of them poets in. But that's not to diminish the role and function of poetry, because the poets responding to Barbara Bush's invitation a couple of years ago to, there were I think five poets who were invited to come to the Bush White House to read. Well, the invitation was rejected so widely that 25,600 poems were sent to the White House.
Oh my goodness.
By poets who had heard about it, saying, no thank you, no thank you. It's time for us to talk about the spirit and the soul instead of just the profits that are to be made.
And one wonders what the reception was. In other words, if you have a soul that's open to hearing poetry in the first place.
I think every soul is open to hearing poetry. Every soul. And it all depends on the cultural aspects that exist at any time. There is no way. When I went back to Italy in 1951, I pulled up at the gas station and in the Maremma, and in those days they still had gas station attendants. And I had my rented car, and the chap filled up, and there was Maremma, and I quoted a line out of Dante, because Maremma was a place where some of Dante's characters had lived, And I just did one line, and the gas station attendant finished the terzina, so that you knew that he knew that he was involved. And I'm really looking forward to the time where poetry gets recognized, because there is poetry in America. There's a lot of poetry in America. It just isn't recognized because it doesn't make money. But the Sex Pistols helped Branson become one of the richest men in the world with his Virgin Airlines and all of the rest of that. But that started with music. And a lot of the poetry that exists in America today is to be found in the music that's being done. But poetry, poets should learn to express themselves and not just mumble. People should be in a position to work with the poetry that is available to them. And when they get a line that is wonderful, it's wonderful to come home to your partner. It's wonderful to come home and say, look, I just found this poem by so-and-so, and you share. And it's all about sharing, and it's all about expanding the horizons that we have.
We're talking to Victor DeSouvero. Let's talk about your background a little bit. You were born and raised in Italy?
I was born in Italy, but at the age of five, I was brought to China, because my father had been assigned to China. He had been in the Italian Navy and then went into the Italian diplomatic service. But being Jewish and Sephardic, I was my mother was Catholic. I was brought up as a Catholic. And suddenly the orders came to ship us back to Italy and break rocks. And we were very lucky. The Jesuits helped, and we came to America and arrived in San Francisco in 1941. And then it was time for me to, well, the war was on, and in 1943 I went into the Merchant Marine, because it was the only service that would accept me, because I was an enemy alien and I was underage. And from there, Berkeley, and after Berkeley, a lot of things that finally brought me to New Mexico some 18 years ago, and I love it here.
So you've been here for 18 years, and you started Penny Whistle Press. What was the motivation for the press?
We started by doing chapbooks, and chapbooks were the cheap books that were sold by the chapman, the cheap man, who in England, in the North Country, would go around with his cart with all cheap goods. And so we started by publishing a lot of poets, and we published over 40 poets in the past 18, 19 years, almost 20 years now. And so the chapman had his penny whistle, and that's why we called it Penny Whistle Press, because he would have his whistle for a penny, and he would call when he would come into a village and sell his books.
But now you're publishing regularly bound books.
Not only regularly bound books, we are also expanding, and the big book that we're working on is How and Why We Came to Santa Fe, because that is going to be, is a collection of 52 stories of a variety of people, ranging from Nobel laureates to gardeners, and from cooks to gallery owners. So it's going to be quite exciting.
All people who were not born here, or?
All people who were not born here, because that's generally the question that is asked when you're invited out to dinner. How did you get here? Jonathan Richards turned his answer in as a one-act play, where he turns to his, or where Claudia and he are sitting in a bar, and Jonathan asks her, how did we ever get here anyway? And she said, well, I've told you that, you know that. And she said, yeah, but tell me again, I'm bored. And it turned into a wonderful little one-act play. But Consuelo Luz did an absolutely heart-wrenching story of how she got here in her bread truck. First at Taos and then coming here. So it's going to be a wonderful book, because of the whole variety, from Richard Gaddis, who runs the opera, all the way to Linda Durham, who runs the gallery, and started out as a Playboy Bunny.
And all this is coming out this year?
Yes.
Victor de Souvre, do you want to read one more poem before we go?
Sure. Any one. What kind? Pick your pick.
Chocolate.
Chocolate. All right, I'll give you a chocolate. Let's see. Here's chocolate. This is called Invitation. Take off your clothes, your sandals, and all your decorations. Strip down to the essential physical borders of your own body's domain. And then take the time to examine how cleverly and well each part of you works with each other one. Then bend, reach, dance, stride, and play, lying down and turning, getting up slowly so as to stand once more to see and to acknowledge the perfection of each one of your body's several parts and how they are together. Then begin to learn about your heart.
Victor de Souvre, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Delighted, and see you all
On Sunday. Sunday, the 20th of May, from 4 to 7, right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company. It is the release for the new book, Moving On, New and Selected Poems by Victor de Souvre. We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Sally Denton. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Sally Denton. She is the author of a number of books, including the latest one, Passion and Principle, John and Jesse Fremont, the couple whose power, politics, and love shaped 19th century America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And you'll be reading at Garcia Street Books this Friday at 5 o'clock. It's the launch for this wonderful book. It's one of those books that I tend to have to read rather quickly, and I just wanted to read it slowly and savor every page. It's a story about these two people. I'd heard of Fremont, I had not heard of his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont. Tell us about these two very different characters.
Well, they're really kind of exemplary of an era in American history, but when you say you savored reading it, this is my fifth book, but I felt that way writing it. I felt like I was playing Barbie dolls or something. It's such a sad story in the end. I don't know if you've gotten to the end, but it was just one of those that I really didn't want to finish it. But they are, there's been quite a bit written about him before as the explorer of the American West. But she was equally ambitious and talented and brilliant. And she's really been overlooked by historians. And in fact, most biographers of him have really kind of implied that she was the brains behind them. And I think I really kind of demythologize that and get it back to, it was a real equal partnership between a man and a woman.
Now, Jessie Benton Fremont is the daughter of the Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton. And when I first saw that name, I knew the American painter, who
yeah.
I guess was his grandnephew. Uh-huh. Great-nephew. But who was Thomas Hart Benton?
Well, at the time, he was the most powerful senator in America in the early 19th century, or the 1830s, 1840s. He really became known as basically the father of manifest destiny. And in John C. Fremont, he saw a vehicle for opening the West to what Thomas Hart Benton envisioned was really a road to India to trade with the Far East. More than, he was also a Jeffersonian. I mean, this was all part of the Thomas Jefferson ideal for opening America to an agrarian utopia. The great irony in this story is that Fremont and Jesse end up kind of opening the West, but ultimately they become kind of pawns in a power struggle for slavery extension into the West, when in fact they were both rabid abolitionists later. But she was raised as the favorite daughter of this very powerful man, and she went on, he taught her five languages. By the time she was 12 years old, she learned to read in Thomas Jefferson's library, which became the Library of Congress. And she was as as educated and prepared to be president as any man of her time.
And she herself says that she was really raised more as a boy than as a girl, and had no patience for limitations and social
right.
niceties.
Which was really kind of a conflict, becomes a conflict in her life, because her father, as often happens with powerful men who raise interesting and powerful daughters, they like them to behave independently and brilliantly until they reach a certain age, at which time they want them to be demure and become, you know, wives and mothers. And
that was played out when Jesse Benton was just a teenager. She takes one look at this fellow, John Charles Fremont, falls madly in love. He falls in love with her, and he's not supposedly good enough or from a high enough station in life.
Right. He's a bastard son of a kind of fallen away Southern belle and a renegade French flirt. Basically, and so that was not, while Thomas Hart Benton envisioned Fremont as a brilliant explorer, he didn't really see him as an adequate partner for his privileged daughter.
Especially since his daughter, I found this amazing, had already received at the age of 15 or 16 a marriage proposal from the President of the United States.
And I think from both of the President's sons, Martin Van Buren's sons. I mean, she was really, you know, the catch, the hottie of Washington, D.C. in the 1830s and 40s. So, and she ultimately eloped with him, and which, you know, angered and alienated Thomas Hart Benton for a while, until he realized that their love was stronger than his relationship with her, and then there becomes a triangle between the three of them that has kind of fatal and fateful implications down the road.
What was St. Louis like in the early to mid-20th century?
Well, that was where Thomas Hart Benton, he was the senator from Missouri, so that was kind of the headquarters, and it was the gateway to the West. And so it was a wildly colorful era of, you know, fur trappers and explorers and French scientists and cartographers and mountain men, and it was everything. And it was Catholic and kind of French Catholic, and that was where Jessie spent part of her she alternated her childhood between Virginia, her mother's estate, and St. Louis, and then Washington, D.C., when the Senate was in session.
Let's talk about this whole westward expansion manifest destiny. You talked about Thomas Hart Benton's vision for America. What was the political situation around all of this in Washington, in the Senate? What was the debate? Everybody was unanimous about wanting to take over the whole continent?
No, it was not unanimous, and in fact, it was very controversial. The Mexican-American War was very controversial. The president was actually operating kind of behind the scenes, because there was so much kind of angst in the nation about this kind of imperialist vision, what they saw as an imperialist vision. And ultimately, you know, John C. Fremont becomes mired in the conquest of California, which was a very controversial situation. And he was, I think, used, I don't think he was the first, but he might have been the second or third major undercover covert operative for American intelligence and American expansionism.
Now, he was supposedly on scientific exploratory missions.
Right. He had put together, I mean, this was his third expedition to the West, but he had amassed really an army of men supposedly to go and map a central route to California. And when in fact it seemed clear to me from the evidence that he was sent there to kind of foment revolution among the Californians who were there against the Mexicans, with the fear that the French and the English both had designs on California. And he was successful in doing that, but then there was an outcry in the country, and basically the president kind of hung him out to dry and, you know, claimed that, as they usually do with covert operatives, that they didn't know anything about it. He was a renegade.
Well, they're the ultimate scapegoats.
Right. I mean, it's not unlike what happens today with the CIA in foreign countries. And, you know, whenever we get involved in assassinations or things that we don't want to be identified with, we usually dismiss the operative as renegades.
We're talking to Sally Denton. The book is called Passion and Principle, John and Jesse Fremont, the couple whose power, politics, and love shaped 19th century America. So what was it that Fremont did that got him in trouble?
Well, mostly what happened is General Kearny, Stephen Watts Kearny, was with the Army. Fremont was actually with the Topographical Engineers, which was a division of the Army. But when he went to California, he claimed to have been sent by Bancroft, George Bancroft, who was the Secretary of the Navy, and James Buchanan, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and with secret orders from President Polk. So he saw himself as... Because his orders came from Bancroft, he really saw himself as an agent of the U.S. Navy. But what happened is after the revolution, the Bear Flag Revolt, when they basically took over California, Kearny, who was marching from Santa Fe with his men, arrived on the scene and took over. Fremont had been installed, had either installed himself or had been appointed governor by the Navy Admiral. The governor of California, and was kind of in control of the territory and what would become the state of California. And Kearny arrives, and there was a conflict really between Kearny and Admiral Stockton of the Navy, and Fremont got caught in the middle of that.
It's funny, I was looking at the passages about Fremont in Hampton Side's wonderful book Blood mm-hmm. and Thunder as I was reading this, and I was wondering what it was like for you writing a biography of these two very colorful people to deal with really the misdeeds of them. I mean, it's your guy. You want him to mm-hmm. you want him to be good on some level. I mean, how do you deal with that as a historian?
Well, you know, actually, I approached this book, you know, as I said, there had been so much written about Fremont where he was really kind of portrayed as this buffoon and that he had never really explored anything, that Kit Carson really, you know, did everything. And I just decided to kind of, what I do with all of my books, I approach it as an investigative reporter where I go back and I try to ignore all of the kind of hype and propaganda that's been written before. And in this book, you know, you will see that they there's been a concerted effort to smear both John and Jesse, and I think because of their radical political progressive politics from the future. And so I did this in the book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, to just try and ignore everything that had been written before. And what I fully expected to go in there and find that Fremont was a fraud, that he hadn't really explored anything, that he wasn't really that good, that he was a womanizer. And what I found instead was that he was a brilliant scientist. Yes, Kit Carson sent him, or guided him to places that certainly had been explored before by Indian, by Native Americans and trappers, but never by white men, white European descended men with scientific equipment. And so I don't know that, you know, I love Hampton's book also, but he and I have had some, you know, conversations about here we are doing John C. Fremont and his sidekick Kit Carson. And it was really Jesse, Fremont's wife, who created the caricature of Kit Carson that kind of launched Carson and Fremont to rock star fame.
Through her own writings?
Through her writings, yes. And that was another thing that Fremont was always kind of accused. He wrote these wonderful expedition reports that really opened America to, you know, a national and international public, and he was always accused of not really writing them. Everybody said Jesse wrote them.
How do you as a historian evaluate that?
Basically, what I did is I went back to the primary sources. I looked at everything that he had written and the expeditions, and I really
in his handwriting. I mean,
well, I saw a lot of some of the originals at the National Archives and the Library of Congress and the Bancroft Library, and her original writings. I mean, she went on to be quite a famous literary figure, and I came to the conclusion that there was absolutely no evidence. As a writer, I looked at it, the style, the tone, the entire approach. There's no evidence that his expeditions were written by her. They have a very different writing style. They were true collaborators. And, you know, like, and I collaborated with a former husband on a book. I know how that is. And, you know, if you're, it's kind of hard to tell who wrote, you know, which sentence or which word, but If it's a true collaboration, it kind of is seamless. Whereas his expedition reports were really more dense, and her writing was much more concise and fluid and literary.
We're talking to Sally Denton. Fremont was dismissed from the army in, I believe, 1848. Or somewhere a little before 1849, when the gold rush happened.
Uh-huh.
What happened after that? They went west.
Well, he was actually court-martialed, and then it was kind of typical, you know, again, covert operative stuff. The president comes in, even though the court-martial found him guilty, the president wanted to kind of absolve him and have him stay with the army, and he refused. He felt disgusted. He felt betrayed by the U.S. government. And so then Thomas Hart Benton, his father-in-law, put together some private funding for additional explorations, and really with the hope of opening a route for a transcontinental railroad. And what happened is he basically did those expeditions and along the way acquired some property in California called Las Mariposas, which was this huge ranch in Yosemite, and he acquired it kind of by accident. He had asked a government agent in California to buy some land for him on the ocean. And the agent bought that land for himself and bought this piece of land in the mountains that everybody thought was kind of worthless. And then they struck gold on it. And they became multi-millionaires. And Jessie, in her 20s, and now with babies and, literally with infants, went across the country several times, by burro, by boat, by steamer to Panama and across the isthmus. And it was, she was quite the adventurer in her own right.
And a lot of the book is Jessie's anguish at being separated from her husband and just the tremendous hardships that she had to suffer and that they both had to suffer with disease and the difficulty of travel. It made me think about what an incredible thing it is to get on a plane and get off on the other side of the country.
And by the end of their lives, when they were actually, traveling by railroad, it was such a change. But they went back and forth from California to New York, first to Washington, and then he runs for president in 1856, and they really kind of shift their focus from California to New York. Neither of them are comfortable living in Washington anymore because it's become so politicized and so Southern, and they're both abolitionists.
Well, tell us about that. They are both abolitionists, and so is Jesse's father, Thomas Hart Benton, and yet there's a split.
Well, Thomas Hart Benton was not really a radical abolitionist. He believed in not extending slavery, and there was a distinction there between, stopping, upholding the Missouri Compromise and not extending slavery, and someone like John and Jesse and the more radical elements of what would become Lincoln's administration, Seward and Salmon Chase, and about wanting to abolish slavery and having the war become about slavery, not about just saving the Union. And so there was a split there. Thomas Jefferson was also a very old-fashioned Jeffersonian Democrat. Thomas Hart Benton. And a Jacksonian Democrat. And he really, it's not unlike today with the formation of the Green Party. The formation of the Republican Party in 1856 was really exceptional. It was the progressive party of America, which is so ironic, that it turns out to be this kind of, reactionary, staid old thing. But Benton was, when his son-in-law ran for president, Benton was really opposed to the formation of a third party. And he was first and foremost a Democrat. He also didn't think that his son-in-law was particularly qualified to be president. And I think he harbored secret ambitions to run for president on his own, and I think he was jealous to a large extent. And this book, where my book really diverges from everything else that's out there, is that I spend, a much less than half of the book, I think, on the exploration of the American West, and focus more on the little known part, the after, California, running for president and then becoming, a Civil War general and being the first to emancipate the slaves.
Now, this run for president has a lot of issues going on, and one of them is the power of women in politics, despite the fact that they're not allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. Jesse was very much of a player in that campaign.
Well, in that campaign, not the campaign for suffrage, but the...
For president.
For president, absolutely. She was the first American woman who was really, you know, a celebrity in her own right. And, I mean, Dolly Madison had been this kind of society, you know, parlor creature, but Jesse brought women out in the country in droves. And when they first, it was the John and Jesse campaign, and they called for her in Philadelphia, in New York, you know, huge crowds, thousands of people marched in the streets and in torchlight parades and called for Jesse to appear. So she was every bit as appealing as Fremont. And it was really the first campaign where women became active in presidential politics.
And it's so clear that had she lived 100, 150 years later, she would have been a senator or
absolutely
would have run for president.
Absolutely, yeah.
A very brave and highly intelligent, spirited character. One wishes one could have gotten to know her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What happened in this campaign? Was he pummeled? Was it close? Who did he lose to?
He lost to Buchanan. It was actually very close, and I mean much closer than anybody expected. This was an upstart political party, and in an era that was, you know, very, very similar to contemporary times. The country was very divided, particularly over slavery. And the fact that it was even as close as it was, and he really lost because of a smear. And, I mean, it was the first real, I mean, I kind of trace it to, you know, the beginning of the Karl Rove, you know, ilk. This was, they smeared him with being a Catholic, which he was not. It's very similar, it's a piece I'm writing for the LA Times right now, an op-ed piece kind of comparing this campaign to, say, Mitt Romney, when, you know, everybody is questioning his faith and his Mormonism. And just yesterday I listened to the famous JFK speech in 1960 in Houston, where he had to address the allegations that a Catholic was not qualified to be president. And it's like there's nothing new under the sun. But this was, Fremont refused to address it. All of his advisors in New York said, you've got to go out there and say, I'm not a Catholic. And he thought, you know, he believed in the separation of church and state and thought that it was irrelevant and it had no place in presidential politics.
And that cost him the election.
It cost him the election.
Very interesting. So he then went on to become a general during the Civil War.
Right. He was, he set the stage for Lincoln, really, to run for president in 1860. And by that time, it was clear the country was ready for a new party. The country was ready to address slavery. And Lincoln basically benefited from, you know, what Fremont, the powers that be behind him really kind of threw him out there as a, you know, to test the waters. And they were shocked at how successful he had been and how close the election really had been. So it was. It became clear that it was a viable party and that Lincoln was the one to run. So there was a lot of pressure on Lincoln to appoint him to a Civil War position. And he had this. Fremont had this great following of soldiers and men throughout the country. So he was kind of a no-brainer. And they put him in charge of the Western Department in St. Louis. And he inherited a chaotic and crazy situation at the beginning of the war. And ultimately, he ended up emancipating the slaves, which angered Lincoln. And one of my favorite scenes, and in fact, the scene that inspired me to write the book to begin with, is when Jesse gets on the train in St. Louis and, you know, rides for 2 days to get to Washington to confront Abraham Lincoln and explain the situation on the ground. And Lincoln is not only furious that that Fremont has undercut him by freeing the slaves a year before Lincoln was even seriously thinking about doing that, but that he had the audacity to send a woman. And I just thought it was so interesting that here was Jesse, who had been an advisor to five different presidents, had worked as a translator and covert operative for two presidents, and that she was so dismissed by him. By Lincoln, it was really, I mean, here's a woman coming from the front lines of a war, and Lincoln didn't want to hear anything she had to say about it.
We're talking to Sally Denton. I wanted to ask you, I mean, they were staunch abolitionists. How did they feel about the Indians? I mean, the manifest destiny, the expansion with which they were involved, was a terrible thing for the people already living in the Western continent.
Well, they were both conflicted by all of that. Although, you know, Fremont was very, at the end of his life, when he goes on the train back out to California, you know, he thinks, I mean, he bought into the kind of Jacksonian policy of, you know, the moving the Indians, relocating the Indians, the Cherokees. He was a participant in that campaign. In the West, I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that he was, you know, that either of them were racist or in fact, she was very upset, not as much by the Indians, but as the native Californians who were displaced after the conquest. And both of them were very depressed about how the Indians throughout the country had really, you know, been forced to become farmers when that was so not in their nature.
So what happened?
But there's no evidence of him having any, you know, I mean, killing out of, I mean, there was one terrible massacre in California where the Indians attacked his men and then they took retaliation. But other than that, there's no evidence anywhere of Fremont really participating in any, you know, atrocities or...
Right. It's interesting to read books about the 19th century because they give you a mirror into our own past that we really forget about. And it's also, I mean, it's a time where you have slavery, where you have people regularly fighting duels, where you have...
I love that part.
I know. I mean, it was just de rigueur to fight a duel.
Uh-huh.
You, as a man, you
challenge
almost couldn't
somebody.
Get away with not fighting a duel. But also to see the Indians as almost... you know, part of the natural habitat as opposed to really part of the human population.
Well, and see, I think Fremont really did see them as something. I mean, he was very respectful, and he thought that he honored the indigenous people. And I think it was because he was such an, you know, he loved the land. He loved the West and the grandeur of it all, and he saw them as part of that. And I think that was not necessarily, I think that came from his kind of French sensitivity. I don't think that was typical of the mountain men of the time.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. This is a story of great
grand
ups and
sweep.
Downs, grand sweep. What happened toward the end of their lives?
It's a very, very sad story, but they basically, he is a terrible businessman. He loses all of his money, there's a lot of problems with the gold mine, as I mentioned. There's claims that, you know, I mean, it was excuse me, a disaster from, you know, kind of the 1850s forward. And they end up moving to New York, and at first they're loaded and, you know, rolling in money, and they travel the world, and then it all starts falling apart, and they keep moving down to shabbier and shabbier apartments, and they're making a living based on her writing. And in the end, you know, they don't even have enough money to get to California. Collis Huntington, the railroad magnate, basically pays for them to get to California. A group of women ultimately gets together and buys her, after John dies, buys her a house. He dies a sad, lonely death in a, you know, New York townhouse when he's trying to put together a business deal. And it's just kind of, you know, kind of unrelenting depression from that point forward.
And she lives another
decade plus. She lives another decade, yeah, plus. And writes, continues to write. She becomes a patron of the arts. She meets Gustav Borglund and is responsible for him basically getting the contract to do Mount Rushmore. You know, she's always promoting other writers and artists, and she's just quite a character.
The book
and always trying to keep his legend alive.
That's right. The book is called Passion and Principle, John and Jesse Fremont, the couple whose power, politics, and love shaped 19th century America, by Sally Denton, and it's published by Bloomsbury USA. You will be speaking on, let's see,
Friday,
this coming Friday at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. And we want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day, and you can also subscribe on iTunes. All of this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.